Parikamanavara, another method of approach to the Salaika way of life, is that of avoidance. Here in the sutta, the Buddha cites the examples of a good road and a good harbour. Suppose there are two roads, one good and the other bad, or two harbours, one good and the other bad. One can avoid the bad road and the bad harbour by going along the good road and by using the good harbour. Similarly, if one follows the path of non-violence, it means one avoids the path of aggressiveness. Although the sutta refers to aggressive persons, vihinsa kasa, the Buddha's teaching applies to unaggressive persons as well. For although a man does not now commit aggression, either physically or by word of mouth, he might have committed it in his previous existences, and he may commit it in future by force of circumstance. So no one is wholly free from the defilement of aggressiveness until one attains anagami, stage of arahatship. So we should practice the Salaika Dhamma and strive to attain the higher stages of Aryas that will help to wipe out the defilements. Upari Bhagavara, another aspect of the practice of non-violence, ahimsa, is its tendency to elevate the devotee to the higher worlds. In the Salaika Sutta, the Buddha says that all bad deeds tend to land the doer in the lower worlds, whereas all good deeds ensure rebirth in the higher worlds. All bad deeds have their roots in greed, lobha, ill will, dosa, and ignorance, moha. Major misdeeds, such as killing and stealing, may lead to rebirth in the netherworlds. Minor misdeeds, motivated by intention or ill will, do not cause much suffering to the wrongdoer, but they tend to prolong the misery in the cycle of life. Those who have committed gross misdeeds, such as killing, have to suffer not only in the lower world, but also in the human world, where they may be reborn by virtue of their good karma. Retribution follows for many lifetimes, in the form of a short span of life, physical afflictions, poverty, and so forth. Ill health is often the karmic result of aggression, which was committed in a previous existence. An evil deed will at best lead to rebirth as a poor, wretched deva in the heavenly abode. And at worst, it means damnation in Avicii, the lowest hell. In the time of Kakusanda Buddha, one Mara called Dusi instantly landed in Avicii hell, because of his evil design against the Buddha and the Arahats. On the other hand, good deeds such as dana and sila tend to lead the doer up the successive levels of existence in the worlds of human beings, devas and brahmas. They make accessible to the paths of holiness such as sotapanna, etc. Good deeds help to turn the doer into a rich man or a king, as in the case of a flower girl who offered the Buddha some food and before long became the queen of King Kosala. When a bottle of oil is broken in water, the heavy pieces of glass sink while the light oil rises up. Likewise, bad deeds tend to drag down a person, whereas good deeds contribute to his uplift. A man who does good deeds will enjoy longevity, good health, beauty, and so on. He will become a deva or a brahma in a future life. He can also attain the paths of holiness. The person who has thus made spiritual or material progress on the basis of his good deeds is well secure. So you should seek higher status, spiritual or otherwise, through the practice of non-aggression. Parinibbana-vara. We now come to the last aspect of Salaika practice, viz. that of extinguishing the fires of defilements. In the Salaka Sutta, the Buddha says that there is no reason why a man who is wholly sunk in a quagmire will be able to save another man in a similar predicament. But it is reasonable to assume that a man who is not sunk in the quagmire can save another man who is not bogged down in the mud. Likewise, only the man who has disciplined himself, trained himself in the threefold division of the Eightfold Noble Path, and extinguished the fires of defilements, will be able to help another man in regard to discipline, training, and extinction of defilements. According to the commentaries, the quagmire in the sutta refers to sensual pleasures, and a person who loves pleasure is likened to a man sunk in a quagmire. The implication is that a man who is mired in pleasure cannot save another man from a similar entanglement. This should be especially borne in mind by those who give instructions in meditation without having practiced it, as well as by those who are being guided by such teachers. The commentaries say that there are people who have become enlightened after hearing the speeches of the worldlings, and that such enlightenment through proper reflection on proper speeches means deliverance by the Buddha, but such cases are exceptional. Here, the substance of the Buddha's teaching is that one is not free from the dangers of samsara, life cycle, and the lower worlds, cannot free others from such dangers, that one who has not overcome defilements cannot help others to do so, just as a fire cannot be used for putting out another fire. So also a defilement cannot neutralize another defilement. Violence cannot extinguish violence. It can be ended only by non-violence. Let us now vow that we will avoid violence, that we will cultivate thoughts of non-violence, that we will keep off violence with non-violence, and that we will raise our status through non-violence, and that we will put out the fire of defilement of violence with non-violence. These are the five varas, aspects of Salaka practice, which the Buddha explains in the sutta. Karmic effects of violence and non-violence. The karmic effects of violence and non-violence are spelled out in the Chula Karma Vibhanga Sutta of Majjhima Nikaya. Subha, a young man, asked the Buddha why some people live long, why some live only a few years, why some are healthy and some unhealthy, why some are good-looking and some ugly, and so forth. And the Buddha says, all living beings have their own deeds, their karma, as their own possessions. They inherit their karma. Karma is the main cause of their present condition. They have karma as their main support. It is karma which determines their lot in life. In response to the request of Supa, the Buddha enlarged on the karmic results of violence and non-violence. The gist of the Buddha's teaching is that those who treat others cruelly go to hell after death. On release from hell, they suffer from many diseases wherever they are reborn. On the other hand, the Deva world is the post-mortem destiny of the kind-hearted people who practice non-violence. And when they again become human beings, they are free from disease and are healthy. The story of Tera Putigatatisa. The karmic consequence of cruelty and violence is evident in the story of a bhikkhu Tissa who lived in Sarvati city in the lifetime of the Buddha. While training himself in the spheres of morality, concentration, and wisdom, the bhikkhu became ill. There appeared on his body boils that became bigger and bigger until they burst and turned into ugly ulcers. His bones decayed and gave way. His body was rotting, and even his relatives and disciples ceased to look after him. This is no wonder, because people usually have little patience even with their parents if they happen to be victims of chronic incurable diseases. Seeing Tissa in this sad plight and his potential for arahatship, the Buddha visited him. The monks nearby could no longer remain indifferent. The Buddha had the sick monk's garment removed, washed and dried. He was bathed in warm water and redressed. Then, as the monk lay on the bed, relieved and composed, the Buddha stood at the head of the bed and uttered a verse which may be translated in prose as follows. Tissa, before long you will be devoid of consciousness and cast off at the cemetery by your fellow monks. Your body will lie there like a useless log. By this verse, the Buddha reminded Tissa of the need to practice the Dharma, since he had nothing else on which he could rely in his last moment. Once he became lifeless, nobody would care for his corpse. It would become rotten and loathsome in a couple of days. It would be abandoned at the cemetery, just as people take away only good timber for making chairs, bedsteads, and leave the odds and ends in the forest. The relics of the Arahat. As he had had some training, Tissa became an Arahat on hearing the verse, and before long he passed away. The Buddha had the corpse burnt and the bones enshrined in a chetia pagoda. The bones left over after the cremation of a deceased Arahat are what we call his relics. Burmese Buddhists usually believe that the relics of the Arahats are spherical objects like those of the Buddha. This is not true. Only the Buddha's relics are somewhat like tiny balls as a result of his will. When we went to Calcutta to receive and convey the relics of the two chief disciples to Burma, we found them just like ordinary bones. There is no doubt that the relics of other Arahats too are nothing more than human bones. The popular belief that the relics of a revered saint turn up in the shape of balls after cremation is therefore to be taken with a grain of salt, a pinch of salt. The previous life of Tissa, the monks after the Buddha asked the Buddha about the destiny of their late co-religionist. The Buddha said that he had attained Nibbana. They asked the Buddha why Tissa had suffered so much, despite his potentiality for sainthood. According to the Buddha, Tissa was a fowler in the time of Kassapa Buddha. He killed and sold birds. As for the birds which remained unsold at the end of the day, he broke their wings and legs. Perhaps, what with nothing like cold storage in those days, there was no other way to keep the birds fresh and alive. For thus mutilating and killing the birds, he suffered for a long time in hell, and when he was reborn in the human world, he had many diseases, and in his last existence, his bad karma was worked out to its bitter end. His attainment for arahatship was in part due to his offer of food and to an arahat, together with a prayer for sainthood during his life as a fowler. Those who are kind and avoid violence will be free from disease and ill health in a future life, like Terabakula. When I was in Mol, Maine, I met a woman whose health was simply amazing. She was in her early 60s, and yet she had never taken any medicine and never had an ailment like headache or cold. The part of Mol, Maine in which I resided was malaria infested, and I had an attack every 2 or 3 months, but the woman was immune, although she had lived there the whole year. Her health was most probably due to the practice of non-violence and kindliness in her previous existence. So in order to enjoy good health and freedom from disease, you should lead a life of non-violence and kindliness. Panatipata, taking life. The abstinence from taking life is one of the 5 precepts, and so it is familiar to Buddhists, but it needs elaboration. The Pali term for taking life is Panatipata. Pana means a living being or life. Ati means very quickly. And pata means to take something full, to make something full. So Panatipata literally means to cut off a life prematurely. As in the case of non-violence, the Buddha's discourse on abstinence from killing deals with its five aspects. Salekavara, those who do not practice the Saleka way of life, leading to the elimination of defilements, will not hesitate to take life. Yet such people are really afraid of death. The Buddha stresses the fact that every living being fears danger and death. This does not apply to the arahats and the Aryas at the Anagami stage, but these saints are few and far between. All over the world, the law of the jungle reigns supreme. Big animals kill and eat small animals for their self-preservation. This is true of both land and sea animals. As the Buddha says, in the animal world, cannibalism at the expense of the weak is the order of the day. But animals are not worse than man in this respect, for man consumes many kinds of animals, including the birds in the air, and even the big whales in the distant seas. To take life and preserve one's body at the sacrifice of other living beings is indeed downright injustice. Yet people who kill for their own survival are much afraid of death. They are more afraid of being killed by others or of being eaten by animals, lions, tigers, or big serpents. Once a group of Americans tried to catch dragons on an Indonesian island. These dragons are bigger than man. The Americans shot them dead or set traps to catch them alive. On one occasion, a dragon came rushing to attack a woman among the hunters. The woman was much scared and she had a narrow escape only because her companion shot the dragon just in time. And this shows how people fear death, although they kill living beings cruelly. So in accordance with the Buddha's teaching, we should avoid taking life, or in other words, adopt the Saleka practice that helps to lessen the defilement of killing. This is Salekavara. Thoughts on non-killing, etc. As in the case of non-violence, we should bear in mind the other four aspects of non-killing. We should cultivate thoughts about it, cittupadavara, and follow the path of non-killing in order to avoid the path of killing. Pari Kamanavara. Then there is the uplifting aspect of non-killing, Upari Bhagavara. Killing is an evil deed that leads to the netherworlds or to rebirth among the lower wretched classes of human beings. Some people achieve success and wealth at the expense of other people's lives, but their achievement is short-lived. They are bound to suffer in the cycle of life. On the other hand, non-killing leads to security and happiness on the higher planes of samsaric existence. Those who avoid killing will not revert to lower worlds. Let us then make ourselves spiritually progressive through abstinence from killing. Finally, we have the aspect of non-killing that contributes to the extinction of defilement, pari nibbana vara. Jhana and non-killing. Abstinence from killing is moral practice, and so why is it described as superior to jhana? According to the commentaries, the jhanas were in vogue prior to the rise of Buddhism, and as such, they do not lead to higher spiritual attainments and nibbana. On the other hand, non-violence and non-killing received impetus from Buddhism as part of the way to full liberation. Hence the Buddhist emphasis on Saleka practice. In the Pali text, which mentions the popular belief in the highly spiritual value of jhanas, reference is made to some monks in the Sasana, i.e. Buddhist religion. This, of course, means the Buddhist bhikkhus, and it might be argued that the Buddhist yogi, too, is devoid of Salaka practice if he becomes much self-assured and smug because of jhanas. In my opinion, self-complacency resulting from jhanic attainment is incompatible with real spiritual progress. It does not square with Salaka practice that leads to the total destruction, samuccheda, pahana, of defilements. I have already cited the cases of Mahanaga and Chulasumana, the two devotees of jhana who were denied transcendental knowledge because of their self-assurance for 60 years. But for the instructions of Dhammadina, all their efforts and aspirations would have been futile, like those of the ascetics Alara and Udaka. So from the Buddhist point of view, jhanic attainment per se is not to be confused with Salaka practice. In Buddhist Salaka training, one has to overcome evil with morality, concentration and wisdom, or insight knowledge, sila, samadhi and panya. We have to depend on sila for the elimination of physical and verbal defilements, such as killing, stealing, lying, abusing, and so forth. As for evil thoughts, we should keep them off through concentration. We can develop the power of concentration by means of kasina exercises, or by fixing the mind on in and out breathing, or by being absorbed in jhana. Concentration on breathing may last 5 or 10 minutes. Jhanic absorption may go on for a couple of hours, and all unwholesome thoughts are ruled out in these states of consciousness. But the conquest of defilements through concentration is temporary. Repeated concentration on the repulsiveness of the internal organs of the human body will fill the yogi with aversion to a very good-looking man or woman, but once he suspends his contemplation, he becomes attached to his sense object. In other words, concentration provides only a temporary and not the permanent antidote against defilements. The permanent remedy, insight knowledge. It is only insight knowledge, vipassana, that enables us to overcome the defilements once and forever. As the yogi watches the sense objects, such as the sight, sound, etc., attentively, he finds them, as well as the consciousness, passing away constantly. There is nothing permanent to be found. No impression of visual objects or sound is left on his mind. He is not defiled by greed or ill will in connection with his seeing or hearing, nor does the recollection of any event lead to defilement, since the pleasantness or unpleasantness of the sense object is not apparent at the moment of seeing or hearing, and the insight into the impermanence of every object and the cognizing consciousness leaves no room for unwholesome propensities. Watchfulness is essential, for the yogi cannot overcome the defilements stemming from sense objects that escape his attention. Constant watchfulness and the subsequent perfection of insight knowledge lead to contact with Nibbana on the path of the Aryas. Such an illumination roots out the respective defilements. At the Sotapatti stage, the ego belief and doubt become extinct. The yogi no longer commits evil such as killing and stealing, etc., that tends to land him in the lower worlds. True, he is not yet wholly free from greed and ill will. He still craves for pleasant objects, and he still takes offense at anything that displeases him. But his greed and will are not base and pernicious enough to make him kill or steal. A true Sotapanna is wholly free from evils that lead to the lower worlds. This is then the way to conquer defilements through insight knowledge. The Salaka practice calls for such total conquest. Some yogis become complacent when they are absorbed in jhana. Concentration on in-breath and out-breath or any other object often results in rigidity of the whole body and total oblivion. To the instructor and those around the yogi, this state of consciousness may mean absorption in jhana. But in the absence of insight knowledge of nama and rupa, the distinction between them and their anicca, dukkha and anatta, such a state may indicate nothing more than deep concentration. Later on, the yogi may have serious moral lapses and betray his true character. This is because concentration by itself cannot stamp out defilements. For their total extinction, we need insight knowledge that leads to contact with Nibbana. Total extinction of defilements is assured only when we find that we are not capable of, say, killing under any circumstances. If we are capable of killing under extenuating circumstances, it is safe to assume that our Salaka practice is imperfect.